The story behind the headlines. Every Sunday evening at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, presents Caesar Sertinger in his analysis of the news. In this analysis, Mr. Sertinger draws upon research material especially prepared for these broadcasts by eminent historians. And now, Caesar Sertinger.
Good evening. The second regular session of the United Nations Assembly adjourned a week ago in an atmosphere of official satisfaction mixed with doubts. The satisfaction was based mainly on the fact that a major decision had been reached, and, for once, reached through agreement between the Russians and ourselves. I refer, of course, to the partition of Palestine. The doubts arose from the Assembly's failure to provide any means of enforcing its decision in the face of open threats from one of the parties directly concerned, namely the Arabs. All through the past week, furious repercussions of the Assembly's decision have been rising to a gruesome climax of riot, bloodshed, and arson in the Holy Land and neighboring countries. It is impossible to predict whether civil warfare can be averted. It is difficult to see how the task of partition, of setting up frontiers, of protecting two mutually hostile governments on a jigsaw puzzle territory can be carried out by a civilian commission without military aid. The only neutral force in Palestine, the British Army, is due to move out by August 1st. After that, the maintenance of order is to be left to the forces that have made for disorder in the past, Jewish and Arab militia. The British have announced that they will surrender their mandate by May 1st. For 5 months after that, the only government in Palestine will be the UN Commission that is entrusted with the job of partition to be effective on October 1st. Now, just what has the UN Assembly done? It has decreed that Palestine be divided into three parts: a Jewish state, which will contain an Arab minority of 400,000, over two-fifths of the present population; an Arab state, which has a Jewish minority of only 10,000, and an internationally governed Jerusalem with 100,000 Jews and 105,000 Arabs, with no neutral police force in sight to take the place of the British troops. It has done this by a better than two-thirds majority of the members present and voting, but with a substantial number of abstentions and a number of reluctant voters persuaded just before the final vote. The overriding motive was not approval, but the absence of a better solution, and the fear that the only alternative was chaos and strife. This judgment of Solomon is to be carried out on behalf of the Assembly by a commission of five small and disinterested countries: Bolivia, Czechoslovakia, Denmark, Panama, and the Philippines. This commission is to act under the guidance of the Security Council. The Council, therefore, is responsible as a last resort. Yet the Council, which requires Big Five unanimity for any decisive action, is in disagreement. Great Britain is on record against any solution not approved by Jews and Arabs. China did not vote for partition, but abstained. At any rate, the Council possesses no military force to enforce its decision as yet. It is clear that the real test of the Assembly's decision is yet to come. Test of its wisdom, test of the possibility of its being carried out by persuasion and conciliation, the only available means. It is idle now to argue about the justice of the Palestine decision, or even about the viability of the proposed Jewish state. The commanding problem today is implementation. And the stark fact is that not only the Arabs of Palestine, but all of Palestine's neighbors, the seven states of the Arab League, are bitterly opposed. And so are all of the Muslim countries, from Turkey to Egypt and from Syria to Pakistan. We have seen only lately in India what Muslim fanaticism is capable of in the way of mob violence. We have had only an inkling thus far of the strength of Arab nationalism in the Middle East. It has made great gains since the end of the war. It has caused the British and French to move out of Syria and Lebanon. It has exacted a deadline for the British evacuation of Egypt. It has secured practical independence for Iraq and Transjordan. And Saudi Arabia holds a trump card in its rich oil resources, which have become strategically very important to the United States. Like India, the Arab countries have absorbed the Western concept of the national state. Less than a generation ago, they were vassals of the Turks. Today, national independence and consolidation of Arab power in the Middle East are twin ambitions. An Arab unity, weak until recently, has now been given a focal point, resistance to a Zionist Palestine. Now, some people feel that the Arab threat to fight Palestine partition is a bluff. Yet, in a period of high tension between East and West, the ferment in the large Arab populations of the Middle East is too serious to be ignored. Military conquest of their countries is no longer a possible solution. Conciliation is the only alternative, but with rival forces bidding for their favor, the Arabs' amity and cooperation may come high. A proper solution would require more than a surface agreement and a theoretical majority. It would require a strong, much stronger and truly unified United Nations. That kind of United Nations is still a distant goal, and that was shown once again in the second session of the Assembly. Every major issue, besides that of Palestine, brought the United States and the Soviet Union into head-on collision. Four of these issues were brought before the Assembly by us, and three of them ended in a clear two-thirds victory. The Assembly passed our resolution, setting up a special committee to keep watch on Greece's northern borders. With only minor amendments to save the feelings of the accused parties, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and Albania. The Assembly also created a UN commission to go to Korea and supervise elections to be held sometime before the end of March, and to be followed by the creation of an independent government for all Korea. And finally, the Assembly voted into existence the American-sponsored interim committee, the Little Assembly, so-called, which is to sit between now and the next session as a starter. This interim committee is to consider anything referred to it by the Assembly or any dispute or situation brought before the Assembly if it is rated important by a two-thirds vote. It may also decide whether or not a special session of the Assembly should be called. But these American victories have a somewhat Pyrrhic aspect, in that they may weaken rather than strengthen the unity of the UN. In each case, the Soviet Union not only dissented, but declared a boycott of the new organs created to do these special jobs. The effect of these boycotts may be, one, that the Balkan committees will not be permitted to watch the border from both sides, Yugoslavia has already refused admission, and will not be able to bring about a peaceful settlement of the Greek dispute. Two, that the Korean Commission will be stymied because it cannot enter the Russian zone. And three, that the Little Assembly will have to make its decision without the Slavic bloc. When these various bodies come to report back to the next regular assembly, the Soviet Union and its friends will, of course, try to prevent their approval. And none of these countries will feel bound by whatever decisions are made. In other words, the new Soviet weapon, the boycott, may be applied by the Slavs, and possibly the disgruntled Arabs, to decisions of the General Assembly itself. A few more vetoes in the Security Council and a few more boycotts in the Assembly might bring about a state of semi-paralysis, or they might, some people fear, lead to a mass desertion of the UN by the entire Eastern Bloc. Some people feel that this would greatly simplify the debate, but it would inevitably reduce the United Nations to an anti-Soviet league. And surely the United States cannot look forward with any equanimity to that. The discussion of the veto problem, too, led to what you might call a victory for us. Anyhow, it was referred to the interim committee where it will be debated in peace, since no Russian shadow will darken the little assembly's door. But the import of what is decided would be academic rather than real. Yet there are those that think that the little assembly will have a big chance. It is, of course, our answer to the veto, or rather Russia's use of the veto, since we don't intend to give up the veto either. It is a way of getting things discussed after they've been blocked from discussion in the Council. As things stand now, a subject that is before the Council cannot be discussed in the Assembly. And anyway, the regular Assembly meets only once a year. but it is possible to remove a subject from the Council's agenda by a simple majority, on which we can mostly count. Once that is done, the subject can now come before the little assembly as an important subject. Thus, at any rate, it can be aired, and the UN placed on record, if nothing more. Now, as against our four victories in the assembly, the Russians scored just one. At least they ballyhooed it as a great victory to the folks at home. This was the resolution against warmongering, the payoff to all of Vyshinsky's diatribes which enlivened the proceedings during the opening weeks. What Vyshinsky wanted, of course, was a resolution condemning the specific American warmongers he named and for muzzling the all-too-free capitalistic press. What he got was a very much watered-down version deprecating all warmongering from whatever source and acknowledging, quote, the undoubted desire of all peoples for peace, unquote. You might call this a booby prize to Vyshinsky for his undoubted persistence for stirring up trouble. Yet it also registered some of the delegates' impatience with all this war talk and the little country's concern over seeing the United Nations become an arena in the Russo-American struggle for power. The almost incessant disputes between the two increasingly hostile world powers were the outstanding feature of the assembly session. The mood from the beginning was pessimistic, and with good reason. The prestige of the assembly was at low ebb. It had not fulfilled the hopes of those who believe in collective action through compromise. It had not been able to assert its authority with a country like South Africa, which simply failed to comply with an assembly demand that it place its former mandated territory under the trusteeship of the UN, or Argentina, which ignored the resolution asking the recall of ambassadors from Franco's Spain. Throughout the session, the assembly failed even to mention the most urgent of world problems before it, namely atomic control and disarmament. Against these failures, the assembly can be credited with a number of minor accomplishments in the Economic and Social Council, the Trusteeship Council, and the subsidiary bodies. The little Pacific island of Nauru was placed under a tripartite trusteeship. An international law commission was created to work on the development and codification of international law. The plans and designs for the New York permanent headquarters were approved, and a United States loan was arranged for its construction. But pending the completion of the buildings, the next assembly is to take place somewhere in Europe. Is this the result of nostalgia, or a subconscious desire to get away from American paternalism, if only for a spell? Oh, yes, and an official flag was also adopted, and October 24th was declared to be official United Nations Day. These minor achievements did little to lift the general spirit of the assembly as it went on. Only two new members were elected, Pakistan and Yemen, bringing the membership to 57. But no less than 11 applications remain blockaded by the vetoes of the rival powers. The candidates, including Ireland and Italy, are kept out not because of lack of merit, but because of power politics inside the UN. It is a sad spectacle indeed. As the meeting drew to its close, the chief consolation was that it had survived. Where there's talk, there's hope, some observers remarked. In that mood, the agreement over Palestine came as a tonic and an avidly welcomed lift in the assembly's prestige. The only hope now is that by some miracle, disillusionment may be averted, that the will of the common people to live, live in peace, may transcend the fanaticism of the leaders on all sides, not only in Palestine, but in the world in general. Good night.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, have presented Caesar Searchinger. Next week at this time, Mr. Searchinger will be back with another story behind the headlines. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.